with Muslims worldwide getting into a festive mood as the Hajj pilgrimage culminates with Eid al-Adha. Anti-government protests rock Sri Lanka. The president flees just in time to avoid an angry mob overrunning his residence. Also coming up, Tunisia's president unveils an amended version of a highly criticized constitution ahead of a referendum later this month. Hello, welcome. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Muslims in many countries around the world are celebrating Eid al-Adha, the Feast of Sacrifice, that marks the end of the annual Hajj pilgrimage. The exact date of Eid al-Adha depends on lunar sightings and varies by country. Thousands of Palestinians performed the Eid prayers at Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds. Afghans also celebrated the occasion with prayers and mosques nationwide. Muslims in other regional countries, including Jordan, Egypt, Oman, Kazakhstan, and Turkey, have celebrated the event also. Slaughtering a sacrificed or sacrificial animal is part of the ceremonies to mark Eid al-Adha. That's done in remembrance of the Prophet Ibrahim's readiness to sacrifice his son in obedience to God. Iran and many countries elsewhere in the world, including in Asia and Africa, will mark Eid al-Adha on Sunday. Muslims performing Hajj rituals in the Saudi city of Mecca celebrate Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, that marks the culmination of the annual pilgrimage. Pilgrims are now performing the Stoning of the Devil, a ceremony symbolizing complete obedience to God. They do that at the tenth city of Mina, close to Mecca, after staying the night there. The pilgrims will then slaughter a sacrificial animal. After that, they will go to the Grand Mosque in Mecca to perform a final tawaf, or circling around the Kaaba. This year's Hajj pilgrimage is the biggest since the COVID pandemic began. Some 1 million Muslims, including 850,000 from outside of Saudi Arabia, are taking part. Hajj is one of the largest annual religious gatherings in the world. Crisis remains at boiling point in Sri Lanka. The Prime Minister is willing to resign to make way for an inclusive government. Ranil Wickremesinghe made the remarks after an emergency cabinet meeting was held. The Prime Minister said that he was willing to step down to make space for unity in a new government, stressing that he wanted to ensure public safety. The Prime Minister would have been next in line of succession if President Gotabaya Rajapaksa resigns. Earlier, thousands of protesters stormed the president's house and offices, sending him fleeing from his home. This after months of mounting public anger over the worst economic crisis that the country has witnessed in decades. Hundreds packed into rooms and corridors, shouting slogans against the president. Military personnel and police were unable to hold the crowds back, even after using water cannon and tear gas. Nearly 40 people have been injured as a result of clashes. People traveled to Colombo from all over Sri Lanka to join the protests. The capital city has been the site of demonstrations since April. Protesters are calling for the president's resignation, blaming his government for the economic hardships that they are facing. Sri Lanka has been crippled by a shortage of foreign exchange that has left it struggling to pay for fuel, food, and medicine. The island nation has sought an International Monetary Fund bailout to secure funds for essential commodities. Juhan Perera is chief of Sri Lanka's National Peace of Council. He attended the Colombo protests earlier today and then spoke to us about the ongoing rallies and people's demands for change in their country.
The mood is quite jubilant at this time. That, as you would have seen footage of people going into the president's house and occupying it. They are taking a swim. They are touring it. Hopefully they will not vandalize it. I'm very hopeful that that will not happen. But they have been able to breach that. And what this means is that it shows that the government is unable to resist the people's protest. And I'm hopeful. Now, there is no constitutional way to force the president out. There's a very long process of impeachment. But also the people want the parliament also. They want the government in its entirety to go. The president plus the government, which is dominated by the president's party, they want them to go. And I have a feeling that that is going to happen now. And what we are moving towards is an all-party government, a small all-party government. Maybe it excludes the present the ruling family and the ministers of the of this present government, but it's going to be a small all-party government for a temporary period to try and get over the hump.
The Tunisian president, Kais Saied, has demanded a draft constitution after the original version drew criticism over the powers that it gave to the head of state. The amended draft makes changes to two articles, including the one about rights and freedoms. Those articles have been criticized for paving the way for a dictatorial regime. President Saied published the amended version late on Friday, saying that he aimed to avoid confusion. Still, the new version is believed to retain a broad range of powers for the head of state. The new constitution will be put to a referendum this month and is the main part of Saied's plan to remake Tunisia's politics. Last year, he sacked the government and dissolved parliaments, a move seen by his critics as a coup against democracy. Moving on to the war in Ukraine, where Russian troops are seeking to push deeper into the eastern Donbas region, the current focal point of the battle. Ukrainian authorities say that several parts of Donetsk are now under Russian shelling. They say that five people have lost their lives over the past day. The city of Slovyansk is being shelled also. Meanwhile, Washington says it is sending $400 million in additional military supplies to Kiev. The U.S. and its allies have already sent millions of dollars in weapons packages to Ukraine. They have also imposed several rounds of sanctions on Moscow. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned that continued bans could lead to catastrophic energy price rises in Europe. Russia's foreign minister has also accused the West of preventing Kiev from seeking a peace deal. Addressing a G20 meeting, Lavrov scolded Western powers for wasting an opportunity to tackle global economic issues. Let's get more from Johnny Miller, a correspondent who joins us from Donetsk, about the ongoing developments there. Johnny, what do you have for us?
Well, right now in Donetsk, where I am, it's strangely quiet. It's been quiet today. There's been heavy shelling here for the last few days. The reports that the Russians or the pro-Russian forces have hit the outskirts of Donetsk hard, where the artillery shells are here, so it's quiet here today. In the north of Donbass, of course, the Russians are making huge gains, pushing on to Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. So they're reportedly only about 16 kilometers outside those cities. They're the last major settlements in Donbass, where Ukraine is looking to put up a last stand, if you will, to try and keep hold of the Donbass region. Meanwhile, Russia is using its overwhelming artillery power, over 10 to 1 in favor of Russia, and its air power as well, to damage those positions in Slavyansk in preparation for the Russian army trying to take those towns.
When you read the wires in terms of what is going on, it's really, in some sense, unless it's accurate, which I'm not too sure. I've read through many, Johnny, where it's skewed towards how Russia is doing the bombing, doing the killing, and rarely reports on what the Ukraine forces has done. Do you find that to be true also?
Well, yeah, I mean, to be totally honest with you, I mean, I was in the west of Ukraine at the beginning of the war. I was there for a few days, and now I'm in here in the Donbass region. So I'll be totally honest with you. Most of my news reports for Press TV are about the situation on the ground here. And so on this side of the war, you have Ukraine shelling civilians here, and you have a population which is overwhelmingly pro-Russian. On the other side of the conflict, where Russia is bombing, I have no doubt that they are civilians being killed there, and most of the population, particularly in Kiev and the West, are very anti-Russian. So it's important to recognize there is two sides of this conflict. There's almost no Western reporters here in the East. They're all in the West. So the Western media is hearing all about the crimes of the alleged crimes of Russia and how everyone is against the invasion. Meanwhile, here we have Russian journalists. They're hearing the opposite of Ukrainian crimes and how most people support the Russian invasion. And so it's important, I think, to show both sides of the conflict. And very much in this new Cold War that's being separated, what each side are hearing are very different versions of events here.
And of course, it's very misleading when there's some assumptions being made here, unless, again, if it's true, because in the middle of all these different developments that are coming through, and I'm going to mention the name of the agency, Reuters, it says Reuters could not independently verify battlefield accounts. But at the same time, it says, for example, Russia is moving reserves forces from across the country and assembling them near Ukraine for future offensive operations and it cites British military intelligence. Do you get a feeling that that's what's happening?
I'll be honest with you. I'm pretty with reporting for Press TV. I very much have to report on the entirety of the conflict, and so to be honest with you, I have to go by other sources as well, particularly of what's happening in the west of Ukraine. I look at all the Western sources, some fantastic journalists working for the mainstream media outlets. But so many times I look on these reports and I see in the article or at the end of the article, this news outlet, whichever one it is unable to verify these reports. So Russia bombs a place, five civilians are killed, were unable to verify these claims. One of the most absurd stories I heard in regards to this is from one media outlet in the West saying that there was a cholera outbreak in Mariupol. And they quoted only the former Ukrainian mayor of Mariupol, who fled the fighting before the Russians took over. That's their only source. They couldn't find anybody in Mariupol, or supposedly when there's a big cholera outbreak in Mariupol, surely you could find a family member whose family member has contracted it. But no, the only source was the embittered former Ukrainian mayor. I've been to Mariupol many times, I've made contacts there. There's no cholera outbreak in Mariupol. And there's so much reporting in this war that are based purely on official sources. Frankly, that's just propaganda without verifying the information on the ground. All the information reports that I do for Press TV, I try to find the information on the ground to back it up. But so many times in reports that I've read, simply we are unable to verify this report. So there's so much information coming out of this war that is simply not verified by journalists on the ground, and that is simply repeating Ukrainian government ministers or Western Ukraine government ministers or Russian government ministers who frankly aren't credible sources.
And my final question regards this HIMARS or HIMARS weapon system. I don't know if you didn't talk about that in your reporting just now to us, but it is said to have a longer reach to be able to target Russian forces. When would that longer reach be a red line for Russia?
Well, I think a red line for Russia is if these NATO weapons attack Russian territory. Russian territory has been attacked recently. I understand that it was by a Tochiku missile in Belgrade, which is not a NATO-supplied weapon. But if NATO-supplied weapons start attacking Russian territory, Vladimir Putin has made that clear that is a red line, and he will start hitting Ukraine a lot harder. And make no mistake, Russia can hit Ukraine a lot harder than it is now. It hasn't hit the decision centers in Kiev, for example, the presidential office, government ministers. There's many people more hardline than Putin in Russia who's saying, why aren't we hitting Kiev yet? So the longer this war drags on, the more destruction that's going to be caused to Ukraine. We also have the 10,000 soldiers now just arriving in the United Kingdom where they're going to get military training. That's just begun. These soldiers have had no military training before. And they're being trained, I'm sure, by a very high standard of training in the United Kingdom. But then they're going to be sent in to face a battle-hardened Russian army with overwhelming air and artillery superiority. So I do fear for these Ukrainian troops who are being trained and then sent into this conflict against the odds, against Russia. So the longer this war goes on, the more NATO weapons are supplied to Ukraine, the more Russia will strike back and the more of Ukraine will be destroyed. We've heard that phrase that NATO is trying to fight Russia for the last Ukrainian. Well, that seems to be very much what's playing out, as NATO is using Ukrainians and Ukrainians' land to fight a proxy war against Russia.
Thank you very much for that. Johnny Miller from Donetsk, many thanks. Moving on, Iran's Navy commander, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, says the domestically built Damavand destroyer will soon join the Navy's Northern Fleet in the Caspian Sea. The Navy chief says that this will help maintain the country's territorial integrity and will deal a blow to enemies' illusions about Iran's defense capabilities. Damavand destroyer has been built using the most updated equipment. Irani was speaking on the sidelines of the second day of military drills in the Caspian Sea. Commenting on the drills, he said if similar exercises are held jointly with friendly neighboring countries, the security level of the strategic sea will increase significantly. Israel's Medical Association is assisting the regime in torturing Palestinians in the occupied territories. That is according to U.S.-based rights group Physicians for Human Rights. The group says it has listed the role of doctors who help in the torture of Palestinians by Israel's Shin Bet agency. There are more measures by the Israeli Medical Association also. The rights body says the association denies Palestinian medical staff the right to safety during the regime's raids. It also prevents Palestinian patients from receiving health care. Physicians for Human Rights says the Israeli Association is complicit in the regime's ethical failures and gross violations of human rights. The group says it has already filed a complaint to the International Medical Syndicate against the Israeli Association. Over the past years, Israel has pressed ahead with its demolition campaign of Palestinian homes in the occupied territories without being held accountable. The regime now plans to displace some 1,200 Palestinians living in a dozen villages south of the West Bank under the pretext of building a military zone there. That would lead to what is seen as the biggest mass eviction in decades on occupied land.
The United Nations has warned the Israeli regime against forcible mass eviction of over 1,000 Palestinians from their homes in the Masafer Yatta area of the occupied West Bank.
Evictions that lead to displacement, if enforced, amount to forced deportation and a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention, and therefore constitute a war crime.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs added that the international humanitarian law imposes an absolute prohibition on the forcible transfer of civilians from or within the occupied Palestinian territories, and that Israeli authorities must put an end to all coercive measures, including planned evictions, demolitions, and military training in it.
Well, the Palestinians have been periodically rising up against this ongoing slow-motion Zionist genocide. It's been going on now. The Palestinians have been resisting this genocide for more than a century since it began, when these settlers started swarming into Palestine against the wishes of the Palestinian people. And so that struggle will, of course, continue. And there will be continuing protests. There are basically ongoing peaceful protests in Palestine. And every now and then, the uprising becomes more of a military nature. And then, of course, the Zionists respond in kind, and all kinds of blood is shed. At the end of the day, the Zionists are continuing their slow-motion genocide, but it isn't happening fast enough to save them. In the long run, the Zionist entity is doomed because it hasn't been able to get the actual acquiescence of the Palestinians, first and foremost, and then secondarily, the people of the region.
A ruling by the Israeli Supreme Court on May 4th allowed for the mass eviction of Palestinians in the area. The Israeli military has designated part of the area as a closed military zone for training, and the regime has sought to remove the communities on this basis.
And that is for this additional World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Arafah, Day of Confession and Forgiveness. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, was asked as why the desert or plain of Arafat is called such, to which the Imam answered, Gabriel brought Prophet Abraham to this place on the day of Arafah. At noon, Gabriel said, O Abraham, confess your sin and learn your rituals. As Gabriel said, confess this place was called Arafat. For your knowledge, dear listeners, the words i'tiraf or confession and Arafat are from the same origin in Arabic. Arafat is located in Hejaz and it has been considered as sacred since old times. On the 9th of the Islamic month of Dhul-Hajjah, the Hajj pilgrims should stay in this plain for worship and supplication. This great day is called Arafah. God's last messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, When people stay in Arafat and ask their needs with crying and wailing, God takes pride in these people with angels and tells angels, Do you not see that my servants have come to me from far ways in dust and have spent their property in my way and have tired their bodies? I swear by my dignity and glory that I will forgive the sins of their righteous ones and cleanse them from sins like the day they were born from their mothers. Prayer is the purest worship. Individual separates himself from others at the time of prayer as he appeals to God. Prayer and supplication are the most beautiful moments of servitude. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, Prayer is the cave of answering, just like cloud, which is the cave of rain. The Imam means that as rain is placed inside cloud, answer and acceptance is placed inside prayer. Prayer needs no specific time or place, but God has granted merit to some places and times. The day of Arafah is one of these times, and the plain of Arafat is one of these places. It has been narrated in Islamic hadith that when the servant stays in Arafat, God will forgive his sins even if they number as the sands of desert, or the stars in the sky, or the drops of rain. Arafat is the place where prophets had stayed and worshipped. God does not like servants to confess their sins before each other. This is because God is very kind and doesn't like to divulge the sins of his servants to lose face. Confession before God makes the individual humble. It is narrated that an ascetic worshipped God for 70 years while he was fasting the days and prayed the nights. One day, he appealed to God for something, but his demand was not met. He told himself, This is due to my wickedness. If I were good, my prayer would be answered. God sent an angel to him, telling him, O son of Adam, this 1 hour that you considered yourself as humble was better than the worships that you have performed. Imam Musa Kazem's companion, Abdullah son of Jundab, was seen in Arafat while he had raised his hands to the sky and tears were rolling on his cheeks. The narrator says, In the evening I went to him and told him, I didn't see anyone better than you in supplication. Abdullah answered, By God, I was just praying from my brothers in faith because I heard Imam Kazem saying, He who prays for his brother in his absence, he will be called from God's throne that you will be granted 100,000 times more than what you asked for him. Thus, it didn't behoove me to set aside 100,000 answered prayers for one prayer, which is not clear if it would be answered. On the day of Arafah, the Hajj pilgrims gather in Arafat. This is the place where prophets and infallible imams had stayed for prayer and supplication. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, stood at the foot of Jabal al-Rahma. His companions were watching him. He raised his hands before his face and started supplicating. His supplication, which is known as Du'a-i Arafah, contains the loftiest Gnostic and ideological points. In part of the supplication, the imam says, "My God, I am poor in my richness, so how can I be not poor in my poverty?" Speaking of one's inability before God is the climax of human supplication. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, first acknowledges his humbleness and inability before God's majesty and glory to teach us the code of supplication. Having praised God and enumerating his great attributes, the imam asks God, with tears rolling on his face, "O God, put my richness in my soul, and certainty in my heart, and sincerity in my deed, and light in my sight, and insight in my religion." Ayatollah Khamenei says on Arafah supplication, "The supplication which is entirely love, zeal, and fervor, an Imam Hussein has issued on the day of Arafah during Arafat ceremony, shows that a spirit of zeal, love, and fervor that the Ahlul Bayt should have in these days. Appreciate these days."
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, the scholar of this program is Sheikh Osama Al-Attar.
Arafah, it is said that it comes either from the word Arafah, which means to recognize. So a person recognizes his insignificance and the greatness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's Arafah. Or it could come from i'tiraf, which means confession. So here is a place where a mu'min confesses of his sins, confesses of his shortcomings, and confesses of the greatness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, attests to the greatness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the glory of Allah. And this is in essence the content of the dua of Imam al-Hussein on the day of Arafah. This is a great dua, consists of great, great meanings. The Imam, salamullah alayhi, according to the hadith, the riwayah, on the day of Arafah, he was in the desert of Arafah. Of course, this is not the year that he left Mecca and went towards Karbala. This was earlier. At the time of Dhuhr, after praying Salatul Dhuhr and Asr, he came out of his tent along with his companions and his servants, and he stood next to a mountain in Arafah known as the Mountain of Mercy, Jabalur Rahmah. It is makruh for us, the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, to go on the Mountain of Rahmah after sunrise on the day of Arafah. It's makruh. And therefore he did not go on the mountain. He stood by the mountain. It is called, it is said in the hadith, it is called the Mountain of Rahmah, Jabalur Rahmah, because that's where Allah forgave Adam alayhi salam. That's where the Rahmah was bestowed, the mercy was bestowed upon Adam, and the Maghfirah was blessed upon Adam. He begins the dua by mentioning the ni'am, the blessings of Allah. Ya Allah, you created me from nothing, when I was nothing. And you saved me and you protected me in the womb of my mother. In the darkness of the womb of the mother, you took care of me, you fed me, you looked after me, you raised me until I was born. Then you blessed me with parents who looked after me, with a mother who fed me and nursed me and took care of me until I grew and I developed physically to become a person, to become of strength. And then what did I do with my strength? I disobeyed you, Ya Allah. I became a sinner, Ya Allah. I used your blessings, your na'am, to disobey you. So Ya Allah, have mercy on me. I am coming today to confess. As you will be reading throughout the dua, there will be areas and portions where the Imam is seeking Allah's rahmah. He will use the same dua as Prophet Yunus. La ilaha illa ant. Subhanaka inni kuntu minal zalimeen. And then he would say, La ilaha illa ant. Subhanaka inni kuntu minal mustaghfirin. And I'm seeking forgiveness. Ya ilaha illa ant. Subhanaka inni kuntu minal musabbihin. I am now seeking glorification, and so on and so forth. So this is the essence of the dua of Al-Imam Al-Hussein on the day of Arafah. A beautiful dua. It is said that he raised his hand like a beggar when he stood next to the mountain of Rahmah, until the people were seeing through his arm. And he started crying, and the people around him were also crying and weeping, and that's how he began the dua, salamullahi alayhi. So in that state of spirituality, state of submission, state of obedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam taught us this dua. I was in Arafah, at the desert of Arafat, a few years ago. On the day of Arafah, after Salatul Dhuhr, we saw a stranger walking into our tent. He sat down. We started reading dua al-Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on the day of Arafah. He was crying, maybe the most of us all. Until we finished the dua. The dua takes about an hour, give or take, hour 15 minutes, give or take. After finishing the dua, he got up and he was about to leave. Some of the mu'mineen approached him. They said, can we help you? Is there something that we can provide you with? Can be at your service? He said, no. So they inquired, what's your name? Where do you come from? And so on and so forth. He said, I am a Sunni, I am not a Shi'i. He said, a few years ago, I was in Hajj. And on the day of Arafah, we just sleep. We don't have much to do. Look at the difference. See the blessings of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam that they have given us. He says, we were at a tent, and in the adjacent tent, I hear them reading a dua. What a beautiful dua. He said, as I was listening to it, I started crying from the content of that dua. He said, then I got up, I went out of my tent, I entered into their tent. I inquired about them, they said, we are Shia. I told them, what is this dua that you were reading? Beautiful, eloquent, amazing. I've never heard anything like this before. They told him, this is the dua of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam on the day of Arafah. He said, since then, every year I come to Hajj on the day of Arafah, I leave our tent and I start looking for a Shi'i tent, any Shi'i tent. I asked them, when do you guys recite this dua? They told me after Salatul Dhuhr. So after Salatul Dhuhr, I usually go out and start looking for a Shi'i tent so that I can read with them this beautiful dua. And he said, this year I saw you guys, so I came into your tent to read the dua with you. So you see the blessings that Ahlul Bayt have given us. These gems, these du'as, they are like treasure. Treasure. The aqil, the wise, if you offer him millions of dollars in exchange for these du'as, he won't accept. He'll say, no, I'll keep these du'as. These are the true treasures. These are the true gems. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has blessed us with these du'as. So today, inshallah, we'll be reading this du'a. As you read the dua, to the best of your ability, if you can read some of the translation, try to do so. But the most important is read from your heart, brothers and sisters. Read from your heart. Let the tears flow. As if the Imam, salamullah alayh, you're hearing him reading this dua. As if you're seeing him in the desert of Arafah. As if we are with him, among that group that was with him when he was crying and reading this dua. So that inshallah Allah accepts these du'as from us, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala fulfills our hajat, grant us his maghfirah, grant us his rahmah, grant us his barakah, and grant us the shafa'ah of Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam. In this du'a, more than 6 or 7 times, Al-Imam Al-Husayn alayhi assalam, he says, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad, and do this, this, this for me. More than 6 or 7 times. That shows you the value of the salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. How important it is to incorporate the salawat in the du'as, as Imam al-Husayn done, more than 6 or 7 times in this du'a. So that he can have the dua answered. Because Imam Ali, Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam, says, if you want your dua to be accepted, start with the salawat and finish with the salawat.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has officially announced his resignation following calls from ministerial colleagues and lawmakers in his ruling Conservative Party over a slew of highly contentious issues, including Brexit, coronavirus pandemic, and successive scandals. We now present you an article written by Elham Abedini, a PhD student in European Studies. The piece is titled, A Scandal, Not Only for Boris Johnson. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who, until 24 hours earlier, would decisively assert that he would not submit his resignation, was eventually forced to cede power after 51 members of his government, including notable personalities like the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, and the Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, handed in their resignations. A few hours before stepping down, Boris Johnson had even shown the door to Secretary of State for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities, Michael Gove, who had predicted that the Prime Minister would not be able to keep his job. It looks like Boris Johnson had assumed that he would be able to get off the hook this time around too, like he had over the recent several months. However, this time the circumstances were different. Of course, Boris Johnson would have to stay in office as a caretaker Prime Minister until a new leader has been found for the Conservative Party. Boris Johnson used to serve as the mayor of the country's capital, London, during the years when the country was dealing with the issue of Brexit referendum. He earned a reputation as one of the main elements of the Brexit campaign's victory as a result of his throwing extensive support behind the campaign and siding with such personalities as Nigel Farage. After this, Theresa May appointed him as the Foreign Secretary. His firm support for the Brexit campaign and a winning reputation for his anti-immigrant stance created his hardline supporters and opponents for him, especially among members of the Labour Party. Boris Johnson's political career has been full of ups and downs. Johnson was asked to resign many times for different reasons. For instance, during his term as Foreign Secretary, he alleged that Iranian citizen Nazanin Zaghari, who was in prison at the time in Iran, had been engaged in teaching journalism in the Islamic Republic. This prompted much criticism and commotion. Iran's intelligence authorities arrested Zaghari at Imam Khomeini International Airport in April of 2016, as she was on her way back to London. She was subsequently put on trial and handed a 5-year jail term after being found guilty of spying and spreading propaganda against the Islamic Republic. Eventually, Boris Johnson resigned in protest at May's performance concerning the Brexit and later became Prime Minister himself. Johnson is the third Prime Minister to submit his resignation since the Brexit referendum. It looks like there is no end to the British Premier's bad luck streak. By expressing such remarks as his comparing burqa-wearing women to letterboxes and his decision to send migrants to Rwanda, Johnson worked up a xenophobic and anti-immigrant image for himself. Criticism of Boris Johnson came to a head after the Partygate scandal. The scandal developed after it became known that Boris Johnson had broken the rules by attending parties during the coronavirus lockdown. The situation worsened to the extent that a couple of weeks ago he was faced with a confidence vote, which he survived and remained in office. However, accusations of sexual misconduct against Chris Pincher, Deputy Chief Whip, rekindled the flames of criticism against Johnson. Prior to Chris Pincher, 5 other Tory MPs had likewise been faced with accusations of sexual misconduct. These include Neil Parish's watching inappropriate photos during a House of Commons session, accusations of sexual assault against a minor by Imran Ahmed Khan, and David Warburton's sexual harassment of women. Last month, too, another Tory MP, whose name was not revealed, was arrested for sexual misconduct. Conservative MP Rob Roberts was also faced with accusations of sexual harassment of a colleague. All these meant that Johnson, who admitted that he knew about the claims laid against Chris Pincher, but approved his appointment anyway, with accusations of failure to confront moral turpitude. During the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, Britain sided with Ukraine alongside the United States and provided it with financial and military aid. Boris Johnson was the first foreign leader to travel to Ukraine and meet with President Zelensky after the war started. So one of the first repercussions from Johnson's resignation would manifest itself in the case of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Given the serious financial crisis that has come to face the UK, Johnson's finance ministers, including Rishi Sunak, had repeatedly warned that Britain's domestic circumstances and economy have to be addressed too, beside the support that the country chooses to provide for Ukraine. Secondly, Boris Johnson's resignation translates into the departure of one of the country's main symbols of Islamophobia and opposition to immigration. Although a major part of such policies are organised and deep-seated across British politics, Johnson's resignation would probably calm down the tense atmosphere that has been facing immigrants and racial and religious minorities in Britain. The third after-effect of Johnson's resignation concerns the issue of Scotland's demand to hold an independence referendum. Johnson is one of the serious opponents of such a vote. He turned down the Scottish First Minister's request for the referendum during his last hours in office. Boris Johnson's departure will likely pave the way for the Scottish independence vote and facilitate expansion of the activities of Northern Ireland's Sinn Féin, which is likewise after extending the sphere of its activities and even secession. The final upshot of Boris Johnson's departure concerns the issue of Brexit. Johnson was, to a large extent, a firm supporter of a hard Brexit, meaning Britain's maximal and expeditious separation from the European Union. Therefore, his resignation could create hopes in Brussels and in Northern Ireland that the Northern Ireland Protocol would not be annulled and a hard border is not created between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. Johnson's government has stated that it sought to annul a large part of the Northern Ireland Protocol as part of the conflict between Britain and the European Union over customs regulations. The leader of the Labour Party, meanwhile, Keir Starmer, was swift to react to the Prime Minister's resignation. Keir Starmer said, "It is good news for the country that Boris Johnson has resigned as Prime Minister, but it should have happened a long time ago. He was always unfit for office. He has been responsible for lies, scandals and fraud on an industrial scale." The leader of Britain's opposition Labour Party also took to his Twitter page and excoriated the Johnson government's functioning. Keir Starmer wrote, "We are stuck with a government that isn't functioning. The Prime Minister needs to go completely, not cling on for a few months. Britain needs a fresh start. If the Tory party doesn't get rid of him, Labour will act in the national interest and bring a vote of no confidence." Britain's Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng said, "What a depressing state of affairs. So much needless damage caused. We now need a new leader as soon as practicable. Someone who can rebuild trust, heal the country, and set out a new sensible and consistent economic approach to help British families. The wheels of government must continue in the meantime." Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon said, "There will be a widespread sense of relief that the chaos of the last few days, indeed the chaos of the last few months, will come to an end. Though notion of Boris Johnson staying on as caretaker Prime Minister until autumn seems far from ideal and surely not sustainable." Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said, "He doesn't like us, we don't like him either." Vyacheslav Volodin, chairman of the lower house of the Russian parliament, said, Johnson is one of the main ideologues of the war against Russia until the last Ukrainian. European leaders should think about where such a policy leads. Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova said Boris Johnson was hit by a boomerang launched by himself. His comrades in arms turned against him. The moral of the story is, do not seek to destroy Russia. Russia cannot be destroyed. You can break your teeth if you attempt to do so. And you can even choke on them.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The leader's speech to Hajj officials. The following is part of the speech delivered on May the 23rd, 2012, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials in charge of Hajj affairs. There are two sides to what the sinful hands of the enemies did in America and insulted the Holy Prophet of Allah. On the one hand, what they did is indicative of the depth of the grudge that the enemies and the arrogant powers bear against the Prophet of Mercy, the Prophet of Honor, the Prophet of Dignity, the embodiment of the most noble and valuable human virtues throughout history and in the entire creation. It shows the depth of their hostility towards the Holy Prophet. On the other hand, their politicians adopt positions which are indistinguishable from hostile positions. This is one side of the issue, which proved very beneficial to the world of Islam. Even the most skeptical people and communities realized who the main sides of the confrontation are. They realized that the confrontation is between the camp of truth and the camp of falsehood.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
It became clear that the confrontation is centered around the essence of Islam, around the essence of the seal of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. This event was caused by the enemies, but it was the world of Islam that benefited from it. This was because the world of Islam identified the enemy and the reason behind his enmity. The world of Islam realized the difference between truth and falsehood. These are the main issues today. The rest of what the arrogant powers of the world say against Muslim nations are secondary issues. They are just lies and pretexts. It became clear what the essence of the issue is. This is one side of the issue. The other side of the issue is the great movement which was carried out by Muslims. Notice what is happening today in the world of Islam. Notice how Muslim people are reacting. The majority of them have not even watched the film. They only know that it insults the Holy Prophet. Yet, notice how the world of Islam is reacting. Islamic countries and peoples step into the arena without being incited to take action. With all their heart and soul, they express their heartfelt love and respect for the Holy Prophet. This is very valuable. What happened was amazing.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.